Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And I also put links elsewhere for daily matters. Today we're going to do Volume 2, Chapter 2 of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, Volume 2, Chapter 5, actually, not Chapter 2, Chapter 5. It's a fairly short chapter, but that's all we're going to do today. It's a little bit shorter than usual. Again, Thomas Dalton translation. This will be recording number 23. Begins on page 507 on the PDF. Chapter 5, again, volume 2, Worldview and Organization. The focus state, says Hitler, which I have tried to sketch in general outline, won't become a reality simply due to the fact that we know what's necessary for it. It's not enough to know how such a state should appear. The problem of its foundation is a far more important. The existing parties benefit from the state, and they cannot be expected to bring about a change in the regime or to willingly modify their attitude. So the existing scheme is self-serving of the people who are in government, the horrible parliament that he hates. The existing parties benefit from the state, the Republicans and Democrats, the United States for parallel, and they cannot be expected to bring about a change in the regime or to willingly modify their attitude. This is rendered all the more impossible because the leading elements are always Jews and yet more Jews. You can't achieve a change in the state because the leading elements are Jews and always more Jews, he's saying. And the parties, the careerists and allies who serve them, the lackeys, the conservatives, the lickspittles, the parasites, the criminals, the sexual deviants who work with and serve them for money, the career girls, are led by Jews and more Jews, says Hitler. The present trend of development would, if allowed to go on unhampered, lead to the realization of the pan-Jewish prophecy that Jews will one day devour the other nations of the earth and become their master. And that is what we're seeing right now. Footnote 138 there. 138. In fact, there has been some suggestion in recent years that Jews have become de facto masters of other nations. In late 2003, after the initiation of the Second Iraq War that was heavily promoted by the American Jewish lobby, Malaysian President Mahathir Mohamad said this in a public address, quote, "Today Jews rule the world by proxy. They get others to fight and die for them." Cited from the Associated Press, 16 October 2003, Mahathir Mohamad, president of Malaysia. And we do remember that. American foreign policy is almost entirely oriented toward the promotion of Jewish and Israeli interests, due to the overwhelming and primarily monetary influence of Jews on the United States government. Unfortunately, this influence goes unquestioned and unexamined thanks to the dominant Jewish influence in American media. Through their decisive influence on the lone global superpower, Jews effectively are the masters of other nations. So Hitler again had the analysis we have today. It's just gone a lot further. The disease has progressed. In contrast to the millions of so-called bourgeois and proletarian Germans who are stumbling to their ruin, mostly through timidity and stupidity, the problems of the Germans, the Jew, and he's identifying the timidity with the bourgeois cowards and the proletarian idiots, the Jew persistently pursues his way and keeps his mind fixed on his future goal, in contrast to the Aryans. Any party that's led by him can fight for no other interest than his, and his interests certainly have nothing in common with those of the Aryan nations. If we wish to transform our ideal picture of the focus state into reality, we must stay independent of the forces that now control public life and seek out new forces that will be ready and capable of taking up the fight for such an ideal. So you're not going to find the answer by running for office or any of that garbage, at least not within the existing parties. It will be a struggle insofar as the first objective isn't the creation of a focus state conception, but rather, above all, the elimination of the Jewish one. The first objective isn't the creation of a focused state conception, hyphenated state conception, but rather, above all, the elimination of the Jewish one, elimination of the Jewish state, I guess he means, or the Jews who are in the way of it, is the real problem, not conceiving of the state. Conception's not the hard part. The struggle against what the Jews have already going is the hard part. As so often happens in history, the main difficulty isn't establishing a new order, but clearing the ground for it. Prejudices and special interests join together in forming a common front, attempting by all means to prevent the victory of any new idea that's disagreeable or threatening to them. That's why the fighter for a new idea is unfortunately, and despite his desire for positive work, compelled to wage a negative battle first in order to abolish the existing state of affairs. And that's somewhat disagreed with by who? What? Buckminster Fuller, and I think either Aristotle or Plato said, you got to don't worry about collapsing the existing system, build a better one, and then replace it. But Hitler was doing both at the same time. But here he directly says that the fighter is compelled to wage a negative battle first in order to abolish the existing state of affairs. Section 5.1, struggle and criticism. As displeasing as it may be to the individual, a young doctrine of great and essential importance must adopt the sharp probe of criticism as its weapon. It displays a very superficial insight into historical development when the so-called focused emphasize again and again that they won't adopt the use of negative criticism, but will engage only in constructive work. This absurd, childish stammering is folkish in the worst sense of the word. It's further proof that the history of your own times has made no impression on these minds. So anyone saying, just stay positive and don't worry about the Jews and just build your own thing, well, it doesn't work like that. That's childish. Marxism, too, has had its aims to pursue constructive work, if only the establishment of despotic rule by international Jewish world finance, exclamation point. Nevertheless, for the prior 70 years, its principal work was criticism, destructive, disintegrating criticism, over and over, until this corrosive acid ate into the old state so thoroughly that it finally collapsed. Culture of critique, right? Well before the term was ever used. Only then did the so-called construction begin, and that was natural, right, and logical. So that he's saying the Marxists destroyed the old structure before they built the new, and so must we. An existing order isn't abolished merely by proclaiming and insisting on a new one. It mustn't be presumed that adherents or beneficiaries of the existing order will be converted and won over to the new movement simply by demonstrating its necessity. On the contrary, it may easily happen that two different situations exist side by side, and that a so-called worldview is transformed into a party unable to rise above its limitations. A worldview is intolerant, and cannot exist as one party among many. It imperiously demands its own recognition as unique and exclusive, and also a complete transformation of all public life in accordance with its views. It can never allow the previous condition to continue in existence. The same holds true of religions. Christianity was not content with erecting an altar of its own, but rather first had to destroy the pagan altars. It was only from this passionate intolerance that an apodictic faith could take form. That is necessarily true, is what apodictic means. Intolerance is an indispensable precondition. It may be objected here that such phenomena in world history arise from mostly a specifically Jewish mode of thought. Indeed, that such fanaticism and intolerance embody the specifically Jewish mentality. This may be 1,000 times true, and it's a deeply regrettable fact. The appearance of fanatical intolerance in human history may be both deeply regrettable and foreign to human nature, but this doesn't change the fact that it exists today. The men who want to liberate our German nation from its present condition shouldn't worry their heads with thinking how wonderful it would be if this or that had never arisen. Rather, they must find ways to eliminate it. A worldview that's inspired by infernal intolerance can only be broken by the same spirit. by a doctrine that driven by the same determined will, and which is itself a pure and absolutely true new idea. So you're saying only Nazism, my National Socialism, can get out Judaism and what it's wrought. One may today regret the fact that the advent of Christianity marked the appearance of the first spiritual terror into the much freer ancient world. Footnote 139 reads, "There is good reason to view Christianity as a specifically Jewish form of religious terror." This was certainly Nietzsche's view. See Dalton 210 or 211, 2011 for details. Christianity as a specifically Jewish form of religious, quote-unquote, terror. A worldview that's inspired by infernal intolerance, he means the Jew stuff, can only be broken by the same spirit, by a doctrine driven by the same determined will, and which is itself a pure and absolutely true new idea. One may today regret the fact that the advent of Christianity marked the appearance of the first spiritual terror into the much freer ancient world, but the fact cannot be denied that, ever since then, the world has been pervaded and dominated by this kind of coercion, and that violence has only been broken by violence and terror by terror. Only then can a new condition be constructively created. They're not going to yield power by voting. They have to be gotten out the way they got in. Political parties are prone to compromises, but worldviews never. Political parties tend to reckon with their opponents, but worldviews proclaim their own infallibility. Five, two. There are a lot to think about in this. Just note how contrasting it is with democracy and the garbage you hear in the media, always about tolerance and compromises. But all those do is serve the parasites. 5.2, community as the basis for a new worldview, for a new worldview. Community as the basis for a new worldview, 5.2. In the beginning, political parties almost always have the intention of securing an exclusive and despotic domination. They almost always show a slight tendency to become worldviews. But the limited nature of their program robs them of the heroism that a worldview demands. The conciliatory nature of their will attracts those petty and weak-hearted people who aren't fit for any crusade, and so they soon become stuck in their miserable pettiness. They give up fighting for their worldview, and, by way of so-called positive collaboration, they try as quickly as possible to wedge themselves into some tiny place at the feeding trough and to stay there as long as possible. That's their whole effort, just to shoehorn their way into the current scene and feed on the people. And if they should get shoved away from the common feeding crib by a competitor with more brutal manners, then their only idea is to force themselves in again, by force or trickery, among the hungry herd in order to get back to the front row. And finally, even at the cost of their most sacred convictions, they refresh themselves at the beloved swill bucket. They're the jackals of politics. But a worldview will never share with another. It can never agree to collaborate with any system that it condemns, but rather it feels obliged to employ every means in fighting against the old order and the whole world of ideas, every means, that is, to prepare for its downfall. A worldview will never share with another. It can never agree to collaborate with any Jewish system that it condemns, but rather it feels obliged to employ every means in fighting against the old order and the whole order, whole world of ideas, that is, to prepare for this system's downfall. This purely destructive battle, the danger of which is so readily perceived by the enemy that he forms a united front for his common defense, and also the constructive battle, which must be aggressive in order to promote the new world of ideas, both of these call for a body of resolute fighters. Any new worldview will bring its ideas to victory only if the most courageous and active elements of its time and its people are formed together in a powerful fighting organization. For this, it's absolutely necessary to select from the general world picture a certain number of ideas that, once they are expressed in a precise and clear-cut form, will serve as articles of faith for a new human community. While the program of the solely political party is nothing but a recipe for favorable results in the next general election, a worldviews program represents a declaration of war against an existing order of things. Again, present conditions, in short, against the established world conception. It's unnecessary, however, for every individual fighter for this worldview to have the full grasp of the ultimate ideas and plans of the leaders of the movement. It's only necessary that each should have a clear notion of the fundamental ideas, and that the most fundamental principles be burned into him so that he'll be convinced of the necessity of victory for the movement and its doctrine. Also, the individual soldier isn't initiated into knowledge of higher strategic plans, but he is trained to submit to a rigid discipline and fanatical faith in the justice and power of his cause, and to devote himself to it unreservedly. In the same way, the individual follower must be attached to a movement of great scope, great future, and the greatest will. If each soldier in an army were a general and had the training and capacity for such leadership, the army would be useless. Similarly, a political movement would be useless in fighting for a worldview if it were made up exclusively of intellectual people. No, we also need the simple soldier, because without him, an inner discipline is unattainable. 5.3. Leadership and following. By its very nature, an organization can exist only if leaders of high intellectual ability are served by a large and emotionally devoted mass. A company of 200 men of equal ability would, in the long run, be harder to discipline than a company of 190 less capable men and 10 with a higher education. The Social Democrats have profited very much from this fact. They took the broad masses of our people who had just completed military service and thus were trained in discipline and drew them into its equally rigid party discipline. Its organization also consisted of an army of officers and soldiers. The German worker became the soldier, and the Jewish intellectual was the officer. The German trade union officials can be compared to non-commissioned officers, the NCOs. The fact that only the so-called uneducated classes joined Marxism was the very basis on which this party achieved its success, something that was always greeted with headshaking by our bourgeoisie. Because they mostly consisted of intellectuals, the bourgeois parties were only a feckless band of undisciplined individuals, whereas the Marxists, from non-intellectual human material, formed an army of party soldiers who obeyed their Jewish masters just as blindly as they formerly obeyed their German officers. The German bourgeoisie never worried about psychological problems because they felt themselves superior to such matters and thought it unnecessary to reflect on the profound significance of this fact and the secret danger involved in it. On the contrary, they believed that a political movement that draws its followers exclusively from intellectual circles must, for that reason, be of greater importance and have better chances for success and even a greater probability of taking over the government than the uneducated masses. The bourgeois falsely think that because they're smarter, they're going to run things, but the masses are more numerous and more powerful. They, the bourgeois, never understood that the strength of a political party never lies in the intelligence and independence of its members, but rather in the disciplined obedience with which they follow their intellectual leaders. The strength of a political party is not in the high IQ and independence of members, but the discipline with which they follow their intellectual leaders. The decisive factor is the leadership itself. When two bodies of troops engage in combat, victory will fall not to that side in which every soldier has expert strategic training, but rather to that which has the best leaders and at the same time the best disciplined, blindly obedient, and best drilled troops. You need the best leaders and the best disciplined troops. This is the basic knowledge that we must always bear in mind when we examine the possibility of transforming a worldview into action. If we agree that, in order to carry a worldview to victory, it must be transformed into a fighting movement, then logically the movement's program, must take account of the human material at its disposal. Just as the ultimate aims and leading ideas must be absolutely definite and unmistakable, so the recruiting program must be adapted to those minds without whom the most beautiful ideas would eternally remain only ideas. 5.4. Guiding principles of the movement. If the focus idea, which is at present an obscure wish, is one day to attain a clear success, it must draw forth certain definite principles from its broad world of ideas, principles which, of their essence and content, are calculated to attract a broad mass of men. This mass can alone guarantee that the worldview will be fought for. This is the group of German workers. Therefore, the new movement's program was condensed into a few guiding principles, 25 in all. See Appendix A, as we covered at the end of Volume 1. They are meant, first of all, to give the ordinary man a rough sketch of the movement's goals. They are, so to say, a political faith that, on the one hand, is meant to win recruits for the movement, and, on the other, to unite such recruits together in a commonly recognized covenant. Hence, we can never lose sight of the following. What we call the movement's program is absolutely right in its ultimate aims, but regarding the manner in which that program is formulated, certain psychological considerations had to be taken into account. In the course of time, the opinion may well arise that certain principles should be expressed differently and might be better formulated, but any attempt at a different formulation usually has a disastrous effect. Something that should be fixed and unshakable thereby becomes the subject of discussion. As soon as a single point is removed from the sphere of dogmatic certainty, discussion won't simply result in a new, better, and more consistent formulation, but may easily lead to endless debates and general confusion. In such cases, it remains to consider which is better, a new and more adequate formulation, though it may cause a controversy within the movement, or to retain the old formula that, though probably not the best, represents a solid, unshakable, internally unified organism. All experience shows that the second alternative is preferable. Retaining the old formula, that, though probably not the best, represents a solid, unshakable, internally unified organism. That is the best. Since one is dealing only with external change in form, such corrections will always appear desirable and possible. In the end, given that most people think superficially, there's a great danger that the merely external formulation of the program will be taken as essential to the movement. Then the will and power to fight for those ideas are weakened, and activities that ought to be directed outward are dissipated in internal programmatic squabbles. For a doctrine that's essentially right in its main features, it's less dangerous to retain a formulation that may no longer be quite adequate than to try to improve it, thereby allowing that which had hitherto been considered as a granite principle of the movement to become the subject of general discussion with all its evil consequences. So I guess he's saying even if you have to change a little bit, just leave your program the way it was, and otherwise it's going to be a bunch of stupid squabbling and waste your unity and your force. And the people start infighting, true infighting. Infighting is one of the most misused terms. It's only infighting if you've already agreed that you're on the same side. It's not infighting when people who are conservative and who agree with a lot of what you say argue something else. You're not part of any kind of a group. It's not infighting. It's just fighting. It's long been a bugaboo with me and a peeve of mine that people don't. It's under the umbrella of not taking who we are seriously, but simply assuming we means anyone in the right and Christians, conservatives, and Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. No, you have to be extremely clear about who we are. That's the first duty. Hitler says, this is particularly impossible as long as the movement is still fighting for victory. How could we inspire people with blind faith in a doctrine's truth if doubt and uncertainty are spread by constant changes in its external form. The essentials of a teaching must never be sought in external formulas, but always in an inner meaning. And this is unchangeable. And in its interest, one can only wish that a movement should exclude everything that tends towards disintegration and uncertainty in order to preserve the necessary force. Everyone on the same page with all the energy directed at the enemy, not internal squabbling. Here again, says Hitler, we can learn from the Catholic Church. Though sometimes, and often quite unnecessarily, its dogmatic system is in conflict with the exact sciences and research, it's unwilling to sacrifice even a single syllable of its teachings. It has rightly recognized that its powers of resistance would be weakened by introducing greater or lesser adaptations to meet the temporary conclusions of science, which in reality are always fluctuating. Thus, it holds to its fixed dogmas, which alone can give to the whole system the character of a faith. That's why it stands firmer today than ever. We may prophesy that, as a fixed pole amid fleeting phenomena, it will attract ever more blind support as the phenomena rapidly change. Footnote 141. The phrase fixed pole and fleeting phenomena is drawn from Schiller's poem, Der Spaziergang, line 34. Therefore, whoever really and seriously desires the victory of a focused worldview must realize, firstly, that this can be assured only through a militant movement, and secondly, that this movement must ground its strength only on the firmness of an impregnable and coherent program. It must never make concessions in form to the spirit of the time, but rather must retain its form forever, once it's found to be favorable, or in any case, until crowned by victory. Before that, any attempt to open a discussion on the expediency of this or that program point might tend to disintegrate the solidity and fighting strength of the movement according to the degree to which its followers partake in such an internal dispute. Don't say that an improvement made today will be subjected to critical examination tomorrow, only to substitute it with something better the day after. Once the barrier has been torn down, a road is open, the start of which is known, but the end is lost in the infinite. It'll just be endless internal debate and not unified fighting. This important realization had to be applied to the young National Socialist movement. In its 25-point program, the National Socialist German Workers' Party attained a foundation that must remain unshakable. Again, this is like 1925. This is published 8 years before he takes power. The task of present and future members of the movement must never be to undertake a critical revision of these principles, but rather to be bound to them. Otherwise, the next generation would, in its turn and with equal right, expend its energy in such purely formal work within the party instead of winning new recruits and thus new power for the movement. For most of our followers, the essence of the movement will consist not so much in the letter of our principles, but in the meaning that we attribute to them. Moving on to 516, National Socialism and the Focish Idea. And just a couple more pages. This is the last section. As I said, it's short today. 5.5, National Socialism and the Focish Idea. So you're basically saying you got to have... overthrow it with a worldview. It's got to be fighting. It's got to be outward oriented. You got to set your program. They got to attract the mass of people, the workers, and they got to remain fixed. You can't be always altering and tinkering and proposing and constructing something new and revising. You got to hold to it through thick and thin. It's got to be something people can have blind faith in. They got to follow the leaders and be absolutely obedient, and then you can get somewhere. Everything else will be dissipated. And you have to destroy the old system before you can, you have to clear the ground before you can build something new. And it will be the work of the system, as we know from the Jews deplatforming everybody. They, while you are trying to build something, they are trying to destroy it. So even if you're trying to construct something, you're not going to be left alone. So your first task is getting your own group, knowing who you are, getting on the same page, being absolutely loyal and willing to fight, not vote, not just the peaceful stuff, but willing to fight. And then you have to fight with the system that is already fighting with you. From day one, when you hold your first mass meeting, they're trying to break it up. So even construction and destruction can't even be separated if you look at it in that sense. 5.5, National Socialism and the Folkish Idea. The new movement owes its name to these considerations, and later on in its program was drawn up, in conformity with them, and in them lay its manner of dissemination. In order to carry the Folkish ideal to victory, a popular party had to be founded, a party that didn't consist only of intellectual leaders, but also of manual workers. Any attempt to realize these theories without a militant organization would be doomed to failure today, as it has in the past and would again in the future. That's why the movement not only has the right, but the duty to consider itself as the champion and representative of these ideas. Just as the fundamental principles of the National Socialist movement are folkish, so folkish ideas are National Socialist. If National Socialism wants to triumph, it will have to hold firm to this fact unreservedly and exclusively. Here again, it not only has the right, but also the duty to sharply emphasize that any attempt to represent folkish ideas outside of the National Socialist German Workers' Party is impossible and in most cases fraudulent. If anyone today reproaches our movement because it has monopolized the folkish idea, there's only one answer to give. Not only monopolized, but we practically created it. We created it. For us, they were just a bunch of clowns. For what previously existed under this name was utterly incapable of influencing the destiny of our people, since all those ideas lacked a clear and coherent formulation. In most cases, they were nothing but isolated and disconnected notions of greater or lesser soundness, quite frequently contradictory, and in no case was there any internal cohesion among them. And even if this cohesion existed, it would have been much too weak to orient and build any movement. Only the National Socialist movement has accomplished this. All kinds of associations and groups, big and little, and even the big parties, now claim the title folkish, and this is one result of the influence of the National Socialist movement. Without this work, none of these parties would even have thought of mentioning the word folkish at all. That word would have meant nothing to them, and especially their leaders would have had nothing to do with it. Only the work of the NSDAP gave this idea meaning, and only then was it adopted by all kinds of people. Above all, our party has shown the force of the folkish idea by our successful activity, so that the others, in order to keep up, must seek out similar ends. Just as before, when they exploited everything to serve their petty electoral purposes, today they use the folkish concept only as an external and empty phrase for the purpose of counteracting the attractive force of the National Socialist movement, kind of like Trump telling whites what they want to hear, but never doing anything for them, doing everything for Jews. They'll try to cream off your arguments and sell them to people for votes, but that they will never actually lead a real movement. Only the desire to maintain their existence and the fear that our new worldview-based movement may prevail, and because they feel that its universal and exclusive character poses a danger for them, only for these reasons do they use words that they repudiated 8 years ago, derided 7 years ago, branded as absurd 6 years ago, combated 5 years ago, hated 4 years ago, persecuted 3 years ago, and finally 2 years ago, annexed and incorporated into their present political vocabulary as war slogans in their struggle. So once we made this stuff popular and made it catch on, they started trying to steal it, Hitler says. And so it's necessary, even now, to call attention to the fact that not one of these parties has the slightest idea of what the German nation needs. Not one party in America has the slightest idea of what the white men need. The most striking proof of this is the superficial way in which they use the word folkish. Not less dangerous are those who run about as semi-folkish, formulating fantastic schemes based mostly on nothing other than a fixed idea that, in itself, might be right, but which, because it's an isolated concept, is useless in the formation of a great unified fighting community. Great unified fighting community. And in any case, it's unsuited to building one. These people who concoct a program partly from their own ideas and partly from that which they have read are often more dangerous than the open enemies of the folkish idea. At best, they are sterile theorists, but mostly they are mischievous braggarts. They believe that they can mask their intellectual and mental emptiness with flowing beards and ancient German gestures. In the face of all these futile attempts, it's therefore worthwhile to recall the time when the Young National Socialist Movement began its fight. And that will lead into what we're going to do next time, but this will wrap it up for now. And there he's saying, he's again repeating that it's got to be simple, unified, not change externally. You got to have the best leaders, and you got to have devoted, obedient, really blind faith in the followers. And you got to be willing to fight overall. You have to fight for this thing. You figure out what needs to be done. You formulate a program. You create a party. And you get rid of the internal debate and say, this is what we're going to do. Are you on board? You should be on board. The future of Germany is tied up in your decision. You as a lone, independent German man, you as a white man are part of the future of your country and your race. And if we work together as a team white, we can repeat what they did then. Or it has to take that kind of a form. And so he's voting in parliaments. Come on, that's not the serious stuff. The opponent isn't democratic. The opponent is a deplatformer. Well, deplatforming is just dictatorship by another word. It's a euphemism for dictatorship, right? Anyway, this has been recording 23 out of Mein Kampf, Dalton Translation, Volume 2, Chapter 5. We did solely and exclusively Chapter 5 in this recording number 23. Thank you for being with me today as part of the Learning College. And I'll be back with you again for more real soon.